Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Alamine Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. It is hard to imagine a world without Tina Turner. She had a voice like no other. Yesterday, an icon died, and today on the show, we are remembering Tina Turner and everything that she gave us. Listen to that voice. She was called the Queen of Rock and Roll, but even that doesn't do it justice because so much of what pop music is now would not be the same without her. Here's Tina sitting down with Oprah back in 2013. She's talking about what it was like for her to just perform and be herself on stage.
When you sing, you fly. You move away from everything that is real. You are into something that's coming out of you, a note or a song or a note or a feeling, and you get totally wrapped into that, and with the motion of that in the dancing and the singing, it's like flying, because you're not thinking of eating or sleeping or dressing. The song and the singing totally takes you out. You're simply
the song totally takes you out. That's Tina. That's what she was doing right there. Tina Turner died yesterday. She was 83 years old. Today, I'm grateful to get to reflect on everything that she gave us and celebrate her life. I've got four, let's call them fans. That's what we are for the next 20 minutes. Fans of her to help me do that. Julie Black, a legend, a Juno-winning artist. Michael Williams, a former Much Music VJ. Garvia Bailey, co-founder of Media Girlfriends. Amanda Hess, critic with the New York Times. Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for being here to remember Tina. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Of course. Julie, can I begin with you as the only singer among us? You know, I mean, I sing in the bathroom, but it's not quite the same as what you do. Let's just talk about what Tina meant to you.
Oh, my goodness. Tina was my music mommy. Tina meant that I could continue. She represented possibilities, an acceptance, self-acceptance, body confidence, vocal confidence, all the confidence. So many things. My childhood, she reminds me of my late sister, Sharon, who introduced me to Tina Turner basically when I was like seven. So, you know, a big part of her journey and her renaissance, especially her 44-year-old comeback at me at 45. It's like the timing is pretty impeccable. What's happening in my life right now. So I miss her already.
That idea, that 44-year-old comeback is a thing we're going to talk about. The notion that she conquered everyone else in the world of pop at the age of 44. I want to come back to that in a moment. But you know what, Michael? You interviewed her at the height of these powers. You talked to her. You also knew her personally. What was she like in conversations? What do you remember?
Well, it's fine. Oh, there it goes. It's straight down. Good
enough.
Okay,
I heard you. Yes.
In Montreal, I was working at Chom FM, and Soul in the City was a radio show long before it was a television show. It was never designed to be a TV show. And as part of the radio show in Montreal, I would interview everybody that came to town or call people from around the world that I wanted to talk to. Tina Turner happened to be coming to town that summer of 1983. I believe 82, 83, and she was performing at Jerry Park, the infamous Jerry Park, where they do the Oceaga thing and where Jackie Robinson used to play and all of that. She was doing a festival there, and she was the highlight of the festival. And it was a rain mud fest. I mean, it was just awful. It was just awful. Everything that could happen happened. And it rained, it poured, there was mud everywhere. The crowd was covered in mud. And the only thing you heard about that festival was that Tina Turner was incredible and brought it home where it should be. And everybody stayed. Nobody left. Everybody stayed for Tina Turner. And after that, I interviewed her. She was gracious. She was wonderful. She was unapologetic about anything. And she reminded me of the women in my family. She really did. My aunts, my grandma, my sister, my mom. She had that thing. She had that thing that Black women have after going through so much. It wasn't just survival, but she was a queen. She was regal. She really wore it well. And she was kind. She was considerate. She was very nice. And we had an absolutely incredible conversation. At that time, the guys from Heaven 17, British Electric Foundation, had done Ball of Confusion with her.
Sure.
And that's what started the whole ball rolling. They did Ball of Confusion. Then they did Let's Stay Together. And I don't think they participated much in the rest of the album that became Private Dancer. But it started her career again with Let's Stay Together, which was a huge hit in Europe and a bit of a hit in Montreal. And she was like, that was the beginning of the comeback for her.
I do want to talk a little bit about the notion of Tina Live, the thing that you just mentioned, because Tina Live was a spectacle, right? I mean, she's in the Guinness World Book of Records for the largest live audience ever commanded by a single performer. 180,000 people listen to this. That's literally the population of my hometown. That's actually a little bit more than the population of my hometown. So the notion that they were all sort of gathered there to be like, this is the moment we get to sort of, you know, get to witness the greatness that is Tina Turner is just mind-blowing to me. Garvia, just talk a little bit about when Tina Turner first entered your consciousness. Is there a memory that stands out for you?
Well, that was three times the size of my hometown here in that. And that's when I heard and felt Tina for the first time, because I was like, you know, kind of like an 80s kid just getting into music in the 80s. And it was, you know, a big Brit pop thing, and Madonna was big and all these. And then comes this woman who I think it was maybe a performance on Live Aid, or maybe it was when she was in Birmingham with David Bowie on stage doing Tonight. But that Live Aid performance with Mick Jagger was massive to me. And then she showed up in the Mad Max movie Beyond Thunderdome. And that's what shifted my world. I was like, here is a Black woman who was playing this anti-hero, wearing chainmail, and just commanding, stealing every scene. And I thought to myself, you know, we can be wherever we want to be and do whatever it is we want to do. And she kind of showed that there is this agency, like it was her agency that was really, you know, to my young teenage mind, it was like, I did not see women like her doing what she was doing on a regular basis. So to see that was kind of mind-blowing. But I went back last night and I watched Beyond Thunderdome and just like fast forwarded to all the Tina parts.
Honestly, you know? People think about Tina and they, of course, think about the singing, but she could act. Like, listen to this.
Who wrote it? And I say that this man has broken the law. Right or wrong, we had a deal. And the law says, bust the deal, face the wheel.
Meryl Streep, who? You know what I mean? I listen to that and go, I wish she had a whole parallel sort of acting career. That is Tina Turner in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Amanda, in 2019, so recently, you get this dream assignment for the New York Times. You know, you get someone who says, Amanda, we need you to do a hard job. You got to go to Switzerland and you got to go talk to Tina Turner. She's been living there for 20 years. Let's talk a little bit about that interview. You walk in and it's a castle of sorts. What is going on?
Yeah, so she's living off of Lake Zurich, and I am improbably there. She was just, you know, like thinking about her performing in front of all of these people. By the time that I spoke with her, she had stopped performing. But just being in her presence was absolutely electrifying.
Why did she leave the U.S. for Europe in the first place, Amanda?
She told me that she wanted to put an ocean between herself and Ike Turner. Not just Ike the person, but Ike the idea. She felt like Americans would never let her forget that she was a part of a duo, and would always ask her, hey, Tina, where's Ike? And when she went to Europe, she felt like they were the first audiences who really embraced her as a solo performer. And she also, I think, really reveled in the Swiss castle of it all. You know, she told me that, you know, Ike named her Tina, and she said that Ike would say Tina like Tina, and when she went to Europe it was Tina, and she liked being Tina.
Yeah, sort of a reinvention of sorts. I love that.
Yeah,
but that she always spoke with that European sort of
like an inflection.
That yeah, she
swagger.
Never spoke like an American. She always spoke in that I am European royalty, sort of in that voice. Even when she was at the height of her fame, she was her voice was that. So when she landed in Europe, it made complete sense. And it was the Europeans that embraced her first. It was like the Mick Jaggers and the David Bowies that were just like, this woman is royalty. America took a while to catch up with the guys saying, this is the one, y'all. Like, that was the thing.
Julie, there's something really interesting to me about. So I was reading Amanda Hess's profile of Tina Turner, and in it, she has this wonderful moment where she says, I don't sing, I don't dance, I'm not doing any of that, I'm kind of done with it. And there's a real sense of, it's because she gave her entire life to that, and she said, now is my time. Now is the time for me. I think there's a wonderful anecdote in your profile, Amanda, where she talks about being like, yeah, sometimes I sing Coldplay in the car, but that's really like the extent of the full Tina sort of treatment. Julie, when you think about, you know, songs that you'd like to wake up to every morning, that is like a Tina song, what comes to mind for you?
Oh, my goodness. There's two. Definitely Proud Mary, because of what it means. Notion of gratitude, the whole notion of like, listen, you know, what being where your feet are, and there's so much more ahead. But let me just appreciate what's here right now. And I really like, I don't want to fight anymore. It's one of those, you know, I don't care who's wrong or right. I don't really want to fight. You know, I don't want to fight. I don't want to cry. I don't want to. It's just that vulnerability and being able to say, hey, come on, enough is enough. I think as coming out of a Black woman's face, for me growing up hearing that song, and even as an adult and ebbing and flowing through relationships, it's like, it's such a love song, and I would say, hey, you know what? What are we gonna do? Let's talk. Let's break this stigma. Let's communicate.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you brought up both of those songs. Let's play a little bit of Proud Mary, shall we? Let's hear a little bit of that song.
I left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day, and I never lost one minute of sleep.
Everybody in the chat is doing the dance. As I'm sort of looking at your video screens, every single person is doing the Tina dance moves, because, of course, we all kind of know them by heart. There's something really lovely to me about revisiting that song, because it is a CCR song, but like only to some people. Like, it truly is one of those songs that Tina's like, I'm going to cover this, and now it belongs to me. And she did that did that with I Can't Stand the Rain. And, you know, she did that with Elton John's The Bitch Is Back. It's like, Tina has now done the definitive version. Yeah. You should retire this song.
Let's Stay Together, too. Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Let's Stay Together. She did
yes,
that as well.
Yes, 100%. 100%. If you're just joining us, my name is Elamine Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. And today we are remembering Tina Turner. I'm here with Julie Black, Michael Williams, Garvia Bailey, and Amanda Hess. I do want to switch gears to a sort of a sensitive part of her life and talk, because she spoke a lot about the abuse that she suffered in her marriage with Ike Turner. Take a listen to this.
I lived 16 years with a man that I knew there was no way that I could ever be happy with, but I felt that I had to stay there. My ex-husband was a physically violent man. I went through basic torture.
Torture? You would call it torture?
To me, it was. But a lot of people don't know it. And your magazine would probably be the first to make it publicly known. I was living a life of death. I didn't exist.
I didn't exist. Those are heavy words. Amanda, when you spoke to her, was your impression that she was able to move on?
Yes and no. I mean, I think she had a real ambivalence about Ike's violence being such a central part of her story. And she spoke to me about how moving it was for years and years and years to get letters from women talking about their own experiences, and how she opened up a conversation like about that before anybody else was talking about that. But she also, you know, she had difficulty revisiting the abuse over and over again. You know, she never saw What's Love Got to Do with It. She said, I don't need to see Ike hit me again.
That's a movie based on her life that came in 1992, I believe. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And she said, you know, when I spoke with her, she was 79 years old, and she said that she still had nightmares about him.
Mm.
It's
sort of an ability to put some distance, but that doesn't mean that you've completely forgotten that chapter of your life. Garvia, there's a famous quote from an interview that Tina did. I want to read it to you. And the quote is, People think my life has been tough, but I think it has been a wonderful journey. The older you get, the more you realize it's not what happens, but how you deal with it. Yesterday, Garvia, you wrote that Tina Turner embodied female resilience before it was a thing. Why was she such an inspiration for you in that way, do you think?
You know, she was doing it before there was the shirts trumpeting black girl magic. She was just embodying that. And the story of her resilience, you know, the fact that in the terms intimate partner violence, the terms domestic abuse were not even in our lexicon when she came out into the world and said, this is my truth, but I'm leaving that to the back of my mythology and creating something new. And it really, for me, and I think for many women like myself and just people in general, this is a story, the ultimate story of triumph over tragedy, you know? And so that resilience to me has always been an inspiration, not just the fact that she was 40 when she, you know, exploded out of a cannon and into our homes and lives.
Yeah.
It was that she did it on the back of this really difficult situation that she found herself in and found herself out of. And then she did not let that thing define her. Like, she did not put that, she didn't put lights around that every time she went out onto that stage. She put lights around herself. Like, this is me right now, a whole new chapter that's all about me, and my name is writ large, not me and Ike, or me and my abuse, or me and my abuser, or me and my terrible upbringing with parents that abandoned me. None of that. It was just like, this is me. See me as I am right now, and I am powerful. Like, come at me, right?
Right.
So that is what's inspiring to me.
The through line of the Tina Turner story is a story of reclamation, is a story of taking back your name, taking back your narrative, right? Michael, we should tell people that, you know, she was 37 years old when she and Ike sort of separated, and she didn't own her name. Like, she didn't, like, literally the name Tina Turner did not belong to her because he had it trademarked, and she had to go and fight for that. She had to actually go fight to say, you know what, I built the Tina Turner name. I'm not going to get anything else. I'm going to just take my name from this. And she literally, I think, had 35 cents in her pocket. And then Private Dancer comes out. It is this massive comeback that is like, you thought you knew this artist. They've been completely redefined at this moment. Michael, what's your sense of that comeback? Can you just define how grand of a comeback it was?
It was larger than grand. It had never really been done that way before in music, in terms of I'm back and I just don't care. She turned down the role in the role of that Whoopi Goldberg had, I think, of Celia
in The Color Purple. That's right.
In The Color Purple, because she said that was too close to her life. Completely understand that. She turned down a lot of tracks. She didn't particularly want to do What Love's Got to Do with It because she didn't like it that much. She had never sang those down tempo songs. And America completely ignored Let's Stay Together, an Al Green track I mentioned before. And when What Love's Got to Do with It came out, Much Music was just starting and the magic of video was there.
Right.
And the first thing you saw in the video was Tina Turner. You saw those legs. You saw that smile. You saw that face and you saw her walking down the street. And it was just so fresh and so new because you had seen Tina Turner live, but you hadn't seen her like this.
Right.
And I think to the credit of a lot of musicians, everybody rushed in to help her. Every rock and roll musician that she influenced, from David Bowie to Mick Jagger, to guys like The Fix, they all came in to help her. They all came in to play with her. They all came in to support her and tour with her and said, we know you're here. We're here for you. Sing rock and roll. Do what you want to do, and we will help you. Of course, her manager, Roger Davies, was outstanding in helping to bring everything to the forefront and to keep it all solid in a business way. Musically, she had it together. The industry had never seen anything like this before. And she was very adamant that I sing rock and roll and I do what I do. I am who I am. That's it. There was nothing else. So you knew when you sat down with her what you were dealing with, who you were dealing with, and how it was going to go. It was going to go the way Tina wanted, or it wasn't going to go at all, which was beautiful.
I think the notion, even musically, right, like the notion of listening to that album, listening to Private Dancer, is like, this is such a pivot, because before that, Ike had controlled everything. It was all the music that Ike wanted to play, and she was sort of seen as an instrument in terms of that, right? And then she comes out with this thing that is so entirely hers, and it's so beautiful and so wonderful. I was really heartened to see that, Julie, I was really heartened to see in 2021, where she was reinducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on her own. She's inducted twice. She's one of three women who are inducted on there, right? So she was inducted with Ike, and then she was inducted again on her own. It's like, oh, no, no, no. She built a whole new thing even after that chapter was done. Julie, last word to you. How are you remembering Tina Turner?
I'm remembering Tina Turner every time I take a breath and sing a note. Every time I hear in that inner saboteur say, you're too old. Nah, I think about that. I'm going to honor her in so many ways to really to continue to build a bridge. I got a permanent tattoo that's representing connection. I will stay connected. And to know that if she could do it, truly anyone can. And I'm sitting here a living testament as a Black woman in white Canada making Black music. I look at as a result of Tina Turner.
I have to say that there's like a really lovely opening of VH1 had this Divas Ball thing that they used to do in the 90s. In 1999, Tina Turner opens the second one that they did. And she's like, I think at this point she's in her 60s. And you just like the limousine pulls up and you see, first you see the legs and then you see her walk out and she's got the big hair and then she's doing the strutting thing and you go, yeah, like this is a person who has owned every single decade that she's existed in until on her terms she said, you know what? I've had enough. I'm going to go and have my peace now. I got to say, Michael, Garvia, Amanda, Julie, this has been a delight. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. The one and only Julie Black, former Much Music VJ Michael Williams, Garvia Bailey, co-founder of the podcast company Media Girlfriends, and Amanda Hess with the New York Times. For more on Tina Turner's life and legacy, check out cbcmusic.ca.
You must understand the touch of your hand makes my pulse react. That it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl.
There's nothing like this voice. I hope that you go out and listen to some Tina today and keep her in your thoughts. That's the commotion for today. My name is Al-Amin Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm going to get out of your way so you can go find some Tina Turner to listen to.
for more CBC.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
CBC Podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.